You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. Angie Hobbs is the author of Plato and the Hero. She is professor of the Public Understanding of Philosophy Emerita at the University of Sheffield in the UK. She has spoken at the World Economic Forum at Davos, the Athens Democracy Forum, the Houses of Parliament, the Scottish Parliament, and Westminster Abbey. She was a judge of the Man Booker International Prize and was on the World Economic Forum Global Future Council for Values, Ethics, and Innovation. Her new book is Why Plato Matters Now. Thank you for joining me, Angie.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm delighted to be here.
This is a book both about philosophy. It is also a book of philosophy. You both discuss Plato, and you also evolve your own version of Plato more applicable for the modern world. Sometimes the two are mingled. Talk about that process. What inspired you to discuss Plato, and then from Plato launch off into your own philosophy?
Oh, well, thank you so much for asking me that. Yes, despite having a lot of disagreements with some of the views put into the mouths of Plato's characters, I've still loved Plato since I encountered him as an undergraduate many, many decades ago. And I've taught him for nearly 40 years. Firstly, I was aware that Plato really grabs my students. People who are kind of new to philosophy would really get into these dialogues, that he could really speak to people. So I knew that already. But also, in my job as a professor of the public understanding of philosophy, I work with a lot of different sectors in the UK and around the world, our National Health Service, our civil service, and our health research authority. I work with various banks and businesses. You've mentioned the World Economic Forum. You've mentioned the Athens Democracy Forum. So I've worked indeed with the American military, and I've worked with the church in various aspects, though I myself am agnostic, but I'm very interested in interfaith dialogue and faith secular dialogue. So I work with all these different sectors. And again, I found it was Plato I was turning to for help. His views on dialogue and how we can engage better in dialogue, particularly with people with whom we may disagree politically or in our religious views or cultural views, but also and I'm sure we'll talk more about this, his notion of what it is for a human being to flourish, and how his conception of flourishing is not the same as our notion of happiness, or let alone pleasure. It's more objective. It's more to do with the fulfillment of your potential, the actualization of your faculties. And that really spoke to me, that notion of flourishing, because it seemed to me that though we can't always be happy, I mean, it's not always possible to be happy every moment. Sad things happen, bad things happen. And sometimes it's not even appropriate to feel happy. I mean, if you went and turned on the news and saw some other poor city had been decimated around the world and you just burst out laughing, I mean, there'd be something really wrong with you. So happiness isn't always possible or appropriate, but we can always ask ourselves, whatever the circumstances, what can I do? How can I best actualize my faculties, my intellectual, emotional, imaginative, physical faculties? What can I do to help make the situation just that little tiny bit better, both for myself and my community? And that gives us power and agency, and it gives us a reason that we can act even in situations which are really difficult. So that spoke to me. But as you mentioned, I wanted to update it. I didn't want exactly Plato's notion of flourishing, which is very hierarchical. There's just one human norm and all sorts of people, particularly if you are disabled or ill in some respect, don't make the top grade of flourishing in Plato's hierarchy. And I was not happy with that. So I wanted to update this notion, and instead of talking about the notion of human flourishing, talking about notions of human flourishing. So a plurality that all of us can best actualize our faculties, no matter what they are. And that is the kind of reworking that I've been using with the civil service and the health service and the church and the military and business and banking. So, yes, but again and again, I was turning to Plato. And then, my goodness me, in the last 10 years, and certain, even more in the last 5 years, Plato's analysis of how democracies can be subverted to tyranny and despotism by an opportunistic demagogue. So democracy, which is ruled by the people, being subverted to demagoguery, which is the people being led, a leading of the people. My goodness, that has spoken to me more and more in all sorts of countries around the world. And though Plato himself does not appear to have been a big fan of direct democracy, and he's got no notion of representational democracy, it didn't exist then. However, he still thinks that democracy is a lot better than tyranny, and he did have experience of tyranny. And I'm sure we'll talk about his really eventful life, because he had a very adventurous life. We have so much to learn from him. And the warning he gives us about how democracies can fail and what we need to do to hang on to them, I find really, really relevant.
This is a wonderful book. And I think one of the things that you mentioned right up top is the notion of the dialogue, the power of dialogue. These days, there's a word that's much more common in our parlance, which is negotiating. The way I understand negotiating to be, and the way it seems to play out, is this. The stronger says, let's negotiate with the weaker, and so I'll tell you what I want, you tell me what you want, and we'll figure out what we can do together. So the stronger says, these are my points. The weaker says, these are my points. The stronger says, we're going to go with my points. End of negotiation. Really a dialogue.
No, exactly. And you've absolutely hit the nail on the head. So one of the books that I think most influenced Plato himself was the Greek historian Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War, the very bitter war between Athens and Sparta.
Let me interject here that when I, back in the age of dinosaurs, I was a freshman in college, in a pre-med, and I did well with the pre-med courses, but I found them boring. But I found my required English classes fascinating, and the Peloponnesian War was one of the first books I read in college, and it made a huge mark on me. So let's talk about the Peloponnesian War and Plato.
Exactly. So you'll remember then in book 5 of Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War, there is something called the Melian dialogue. Dialogue, kind of an inverted commas, which speaks exactly to your point. So that the story behind this is that in this civil war, Athens was running an empire and Sparta objected, roughly. And there's this little island, Greek island of Melos, and it wanted to be neutral, but Athens wanted it to join the Athenian, what they called it, a protection league, but it was really the Athenian empire. And Melos is holding out. And Athens sends its its generals in to, negotiate. It's in a very, as exactly what you were saying, there's a massive navy and army amassed offshore. So incredibly bad conditions.
Now, wait, you're talking about maybe the 10th century BC as opposed to the current day.
And I'm talking about, this would have been in the 5th century BC.
Okay.
So this would have been in the war between Athens and Sparta, and this would have, I think it's about 416 BCE.
Okay.
And Athens says, here are our terms, and Milos sort of objects and says, no, we don't want to join. Basically, what's your empire? We object. And the Athenian negotiators basically say, look around, look at our army, look at our military might. And they say very chillingly, it's a fact of nature, and it has been a fact of nature since the beginning of time, and it always will be a fact of nature that the strong do what they can and the weak accept what they must. Absolutely chilling. Sort of like in international relations, justice and fairness don't matter. It is just a power struggle. Exactly what you were saying. Now, Plato and Thucydides, we know it does not. Oh, we strongly suspect he disagrees with this because he follows this incident with a terrible Athenian defeat. So it's sort of like Athenian hubris leads to its defeat. Plato, I think, read this and thought, I think this is very morally unambitious. I don't think this is true. I don't think that human nature has to be like this. I don't think the world has to be like this. And that we can do a lot better than just a negotiation between people of unequal power. We can have real dialogue, which is not seen as an attempt to vanquish your opponent or humiliate them. But real dialogue is not about winning. It's about a constructive, collaborative search for the truth together. So I think Plato looks at this way of looking at human nature and the world and says, no, this is cynical. This is morally unambitious. We can be better than this. We can move beyond this kind of power negotiation, which is just about power over others and money and material wealth. No, let's have dialogue where we are working together to search for the truth and look to how to work to make the world a better place. So I think you're exactly right. There is a really important difference between negotiation, whether it's in international politics or business or whatever. And of course, at the moment in the world, all around the world, we're seeing business negotiations seep into political negotiations and real dialogue. And Plato models in his, so Plato never writes in his own voice, which is so interesting. He's the offstage author. All his dialogues have this rich cast of characters, and he gives them all these different views. And he models both good and bad ways of engaging in dialogue in his works.
You've just given me the perfect lead into my next question, which is, to my mind, humans are a narrative species, the name of this podcast, because we define ourselves by our stories. If I ask you who you are, you will tell me a story. And so what that Plato takes advantage of that. He was a witness and understood what Socrates was saying. Socrates was against the written word. He thought, should not write that down, you should memorize it. And there's a lot to be said for that. That said, Plato knew otherwise. And so what he did was he took Socrates, speechifying polemics, essentially, about right and wrong, good and bad, cast them in the form of dialogues and told stories with characters. And I think that that is a very important part of what you convey and what Plato does to make Socrates' points, make his points, and also what makes those points, even where they're different by virtue of the, 2,000 years of quote-unquote progress, where they're, Plato still speaks to us directly, and that is amazing to me. When I read some of these quotes that you put in this book, it's kind of jaw-dropping how relevant they are.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're exactly right. I mean, The dialogue form serves so many functions for Plato. So, as you say, it's so vivid. It just brings you in. But because Plato doesn't speak to us in his own voice, he creates these dialogues which allow future readers like ourselves to enter the conversation. So we can become part of this dialogue. Our views matter. Now, why does Plato care about that? It's because of how he thinks that you don't just teach people by putting stuff into their heads. That's not how we learn, says Plato. You can only learn, he says, through an active internal process. So learning is active, it's not passive. You can't pour knowledge and wisdom into people. So by creating these dialogues and kind of encouraging us to take part in them, he's encouraging us to philosophize and think for ourselves and critique and listen. And that is just so important. So that's major. But also, as you say, he's through these characters, he intimates their whole life stories. So he intimates what's going to happen to them, because he's writing these dialogues, say, in the 380s and 370s BCE, but he's setting most of them in the lifetime of his mentor and hero Socrates, the historic Socrates, who of course was put to death in 399. So most of the dialogues are taking place in the end of the 5th century BCE. So Plato's using characters that his contemporary audience would have known about, like the general statesman, rock star, wild boy, Alcibiades, for instance, one of the most colourful. And Plato's kind of saying, look, I'm going to hint at what happens to them and what kind, you know, Alcibiades came to a very bad end. And Plato kind of hints at that. So what he's saying is, look, I can show you how what you believe interweaves with who you are as a person and the kind of life you live. So this interweaving of belief, philosophical belief, but also and person and character and life is all part and parcel of the same thing. And so Plato's able to say to us, look, if you take that philosophical position, this is the kind of person you might end up being, and this is the kind of life you might end up living. Do you want that? And that is just so vivid. So it's really important. And I think it also speaks to the fact that though, as we may discuss later, he in the Republic, in his dialogue, The Republic, he talks about the censorship of the arts. But that's quite an ironical statement, because Plato is a great artist and he creates all these myths and really important myths. And again, through his use of myth and characterization, he's showing us how all our lives are narratives. And that's why you have to think. You don't just take a philosophical position in isolation. It all forms part of the fabric of your life. And for me, that really speaks to me. It's the basic ethical questions for Plato are, how should I live and what sort of person should I be? And he says everybody can sign up to those questions, even if you think you don't care about being virtuous. You can sign up to those questions.
I'm going to take us on a little detour down something that you said, based on something you said just now about education. It's a huge business. It's a huge part of our lives. You know, we're essentially educated for the first maybe quarter or third of our lives. And recently, the idea of education has been, I think, subverted by business, because people want to earn money and they want to live and they want to get out of, quote, school and go directly to work and make a lot of money. Now, of course you do. But the way to do that is presented as going to a trade school, learning the trade, then going into that trade. So that the idea of education is preparation for a trade by learning what people were doing or just before you went to school. Our civilization moves so fast that I knew a number of people who learned software coding at a time when the languages in which software was encoded had completely changed from Fortran and Basic to C. So if you learn Fortran and Basic, it was not a whole lot of good about how, you know, in a world where everybody is coding in C. The point being that education is not about learning specific ideas, specific procedures. I mean, if you're a surgeon or a lawyer, yes, you need to know those things. But more importantly, education, you go to school to learn how you learn. If you know, learn how to learn, you can easily adapt to whatever situation you're presented with. And that, I think, is the point that you make this point in the book. And I think it's very important that we understand that now, and that Plato just nails that right down.
Exactly. You're absolutely right. It's about learning how to think. And that has to be this internal process. And one of the beauties for me of philosophy, and including Plato's philosophy, is that philosophy can teach you two different kinds of thinking. Yes, it teaches you very good analytic skills, how to analyze a concept, how to construct and analyze an argument. Really good, really important. But also, and this is quite often forgotten, I think, philosophy can teach us creative skills. It teaches us how to imagine, all the imaginative hypotheses that philosophy asks us to engage in. We're being asked to imagine what the world could be, what the world should be, what we could and should be. So it's got a creative element as well. And for me, Plato is just brilliant at bringing through these together, these analytic and creative skills, and saying, you know, and that's all part of his dialogue four, because you have to interpret Plato. He's not telling you how to interpret what he says exactly. And there are so many levels of irony.
I love that aspect that you bring that out. Exactly. He's not telling you what to do. He's showing you what people have done and what happened to them. Draw your own conclusions.
I mean, so just one example of Plato's irony. So in a dialogue called the Phaedrus, he writes about, or one of the characters discuss, the invention of writing, the new technology of writing. It's set in an ancient Egyptian past. And one of the characters says, no, I think writing is a really bad idea because books just keep saying the same thing to you. You can't have a dialogue with a book. You can't converse with a book. And I'm sure this is one of the reasons why Plato adopts this dialogue form. He's trying to create a form of writing which you can have a dialogue with. But of course, the ultimate irony is Plato writes down in a book that books are not to be trusted and writing is not to be trusted. And it weakens our memories and it weakens our powers. So you have to interpret that. So always you have to interpret Plato. And that involves analytic skills and also creative skills. And to me, that's what we need. So we have all these AI systems coming along. To my mind, we're way behind the curve here in how we approach AI systems, because we have not yet thought about exactly what we want them to do for us. And until we've thought about what kind of life we want to live creatively together and individually, how do we know what kind of AI systems we want to create? How do we know what kind of values and virtues we want to try and instill in them, unless we know what kind of individual and communal life we want them to contribute to? So we've not done this really basic thinking. But Plato, to my mind, gives us some of the skills to ask these really basic questions for any new technology. And there'll be technologies that you and I can't even imagine that will be come along in the next few decades. There will always be new technologies. And we're clever enough to invent the technology, but so far we have not been wise enough to think how we want to use them. And Plato's going to say it's fine to be clever enough to invent this stuff and do the coding, but you've not yet got the wisdom to know what you want to do with it. And unless you know that, then it's going to do things to you. So that's just one example.
One of the things I really liked about this book was the way you start out having it be a book about a philosophy, and you describe Plato and Socrates and the literary techniques, very sophisticated, still in the 21st century, that Plato uses to make his points or to let the reader come to conclusions. Because one of the things about reading that's very interesting to me is that it's very different from speaking or even listening to a book. When you look at the words and process that language, you have to digest the message through the logic of language and the logic of narrative. So when you read Plato, and when I read the excerpts from Plato in this book, you get a very different meaning than you might have from hearing it. And I'd like you to just address, because one of the things that you do is you start out with a book about philosophy, and then it gradually becomes a book of philosophy where you bring yourself and say, well, look, clearly Plato's writing in the 5th century BC, but this is like happening right here and now, folks. So talk about in bringing yourself into the narrative.
Yes, thank you. So, and I hope that this is exactly what Plato wants us to do with this, because...
Well, it's clear cut that Plato is speaking to you.
Yes, I mean, we have to reinterpret and reuse and reinvent Plato for each new generation to look at the particular challenges that we face. And to me, though, as I said, I don't agree with all the views he puts into the mouth of the main characters, often Socrates, I still think there is just so much we can learn, because, I mean, the richness of this man's mind. I mean, we may find a lot of his answers to extremes, but the questions he raises are so fundamental, and they live on. And that is why, I mean, this is a good moment, I think, to mention his particular psychology that he's working with, particularly in the middle periods of his life. He says that the human psyche has three main faculties. There's a reasoning faculty, which desires and loves truth and reality. There's what he calls a spirited faculty, which desires honor, success, reputation, victory. And there's an appetitive faculty, which desires physical satisfactions, material goods, the money that might be needed to acquire them all. And interestingly, it's no accident that Freud loves Plato. Freud loved Plato, and Plato's tripartite psychology, I would argue, feeds into Freud's ego, superego, and the id in really interesting ways. So when Plato is writing, yes, he's speaking to our reasoning faculties, but he wants to speak to our non-rational faculties as well. And that's why he's using these dialogues and these characters, because he wants to move us as well. In one of his dialogues called The Protagoras, Socrates says that the kind of philosophy he's doing, it's aimed at saving our lives. I mean, that's a very blunt phrase. He says, I want to save your life. And to do that, you can't just speak to people's reason. You've got to engage the whole psyche. And that, to me, is another reason why Plato writes in this very vivid dialogic form with these characters and all these literary techniques and these myths, and how reading him, you are interpreting him for yourself, for your life, for your own age. I mean, it's called Why Plato Matters Now. And that's a title I think that will always be relevant because there will always be a now. We always live in the now, and Plato is always going to be able to speak to that. I agree with you. I think reading Plato, it's a very immersive experience, and it requires all of you.
One of the things I thought was really interesting to me was the discussion of what true happiness is. And this is, I think, critical, because this idea of happiness is, we often look at it as like, you know, an endless party, an endless bacchanal, pleasure. But what Plato points out is that via Socrates and in these dialogues, and lets you at least deal with this notion that happiness is not just pleasure, but what you alluded, used this word earlier, flourishing. And so I'd like you to talk about Plato's idea of flourishing and how that relates to happiness, even as one would suggest in, you know, the pursuit of happiness as mentioned in our Constitution, which was derived from Cicero more than anything else.
Yeah.
So talk about what happiness is according to Socrates, according to Plato.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, exactly. So the Greek word is eudaimonia here.
I love that word.
It's a lovely word. I mean, it literally means a daimon is your kind of personal guardian spirit. And eu is from the adverb meaning well. It means you're being looked after by a good guardian spirit. That's what it literally means. But as I said, it has this more objective meaning to do with the fulfillment of your potential, the actualization of your faculties. And in his middle dialogues, let's take the Republic as an example, it's about the harmonization of those three psychic faculties that we were talking about. It's the harmonization of your reason and your spirited element and your appetites. And that can only happen, says Plato, if your reason is in control and deciding which of your non-rational desires should be fulfilled or not. So it's an inner psychic harmony. And really interestingly, in the Republic, Socrates uses the term mental health of it. As far as I'm aware, it's the first time, at least in Western literature, that the term mental health is used. And this is an enormous moment in Western literature because Plato...
And Western thinking.
And it is. It's about, and it's another reason why Freud is so interested in Plato, this notion of mental health. It's about inner psychic harmony, where you are unified. You're not kind of dissipated into all your different fragments. You're a unified whole with your reason in control. And the character Socrates rather also says in Republic, this state of inner psychic harmony, it is your eudaimonia, it is your flourishing, and it's also your state of justice. Now, that's an amazing move, because he's not only equated flourishing with justice, but he's internalized justice, again, for the first time, as far as I'm aware, in Western literature. Because if you go back to the epics of Homer, for instance, and the Iliad and the Odyssey, justice is all about actions. It's all about how you act towards others. And what Plato's doing is saying those actions stem from whatever's going on inside you. It's actually what's going on in your psyche, in your soul that matters. And your actions, good or bad, will flow from that. So it's a massive move. And it leads to one of the most, I think, most important points in Plato, and indeed in the historic Socrates, his mentor, which is, we know the historic Socrates said, well, the well-being of your psyche, your call it your soul, your psyche, that's your most precious thing. And the only person who can harm your psyche is you by acting unjustly. Other people, they can harm your body, they can hurt your body, they can kill your body, they can take away your material possessions. But the only person in the whole world who can harm your most precious possession, which is your soul, your psyche, is you. And you do that by acting unjustly. And that leads the historic Socrates, and Plato follows him in this, really important saying. He says, because of this, we should never return wrong for wrong. If somebody wrongs us and treats us unjustly, we should not wrong them or treat them unjustly in return. Now, that is a really massive moment, because before this, you had in Homer and so on, you had what was called the ethic of revenge. You know, you help your friends and you harm your enemies. And Plato and Socrates are saying, no, it is not the part of a good person ever to do harm, even if you've been harmed. And of course, that prefigures Matthew's Sermon on the Mount in the Bible.
Exactly.
And it's one of the reasons why early Christian writers often looked to Plato and tried to co-opt Plato as a Christian ahead of his time. I'm not sure what Plato would have thought about that, but it is really, really a massive move. Revenge is out. You never harm people back. And we haven't caught up with that, have we? We haven't learned that yet.
No, as I read this book and began to understand how you understand Plato and his message and Socrates and his message, it struck me that Plato and Socrates were both speaking often to specific events in specific times, but they spoke in ways that were allowed a general analysis that's still helpful now. And this struck me that the Bible does this as well. A lot of the Bible that we don't understand has specific references to specific events in specific places, but in some of that there's great philosophy. But I think one of the things I mentioned this to you in an email earlier before we spoke, when I just was spouting, the first thing that came to my mind was that I saw Plato as the original minimalist. And the reason, and I think that's still true now, having read your book, because I think obviously the Republic is the inception point of written philosophy. And so everything else that has come since has been elaborated, put a bunch of weird tentacles and extra arms and legs and foot and wheels and wings and whatever else on Plato. And it's been helpful, certainly, and interesting, certainly. But you can just strip it all down to the minimum of philosophy. Live right and be happy.
I mean, he certainly asks the most basic questions. And as I said, though some of his answers are too extreme, the questions, we all have a vested interest in wanting to live well and wanting to live a flourishing life. And Plato then says, well, I'm going to try and convince you that living a flourishing life, you'll do that best if you also live a virtuous life. But I realize I need to argue for that. And not everybody's going to agree with that immediately. And the analysis he kind of gives of the political questions and brilliant analysis of how democracies can be subverted to tyranny by an opportunistic, cynical demagogue, and that process, we might want to talk about that. And also his notion of philosopher rulers in the Republic. Now, I don't myself agree with philosopher rulers. I want more autonomy and agency for us than that, though I would like philosophically informed rulers. That would be good. But a brilliant analysis there of how important it is to divorce power from wealth. My goodness me. I mean, he's so clear about that. He sort of says, you know, the most dangerous thing for rulers is if they get rich. And he comes up with this very extreme proposal in the Republic for literally divorcing power and wealth. So the two ruling classes, the guardian classes in the Republic, the philosopher rulers and their military and executive helpers, the auxiliaries, they are to live separately in camp communes. And they are not allowed to own any property or wealth whatsoever. They're not even allowed to touch gold or silver. They own nothing apart from maybe a hairbrush. And all their material needs and their housing and clothes and food are provided for them by the third class, the so-called producer class, who are allowed to own property and wealth. But again, within limits. Plato wants limits on both wealth and poverty. And he says you need those limits for an integrated, harmonious, functioning society. Now, that I'm sure most of us would think that's way too extreme. But the question is the right one. The question is, how can you stop wealth corrupting power? And that question lives with us still. In the UK, we have a lot of debate at the moment about whether there should be limits on funding for political parties and so on. And about whether politicians should be allowed to have second jobs, you know, and et cetera. And I know those kind of debates about wealth and power are going on around the world at the moment. So I think I like that term minimalist. I mean, in a sense, Plato is incredibly rich and it's and his dialogues are so wide ranging. And you could approach them and think, oh, this is all very maximalist, such a broad canvas. But if you actually get down to the essence of the questions, they're very clear. They're very concise. They're very pure.
Exactly. And pure. That's what they are.
He cuts away all the dross. And he says, this is the heart of the matter. He gets, you know, with a kind of surgeon's knife, he gets to the heart of the matter, I think.
Now, you have spoken a couple of times about the subversion of democracy, and there are two portions of the book. Early on, we have a discussion about sophists and speakers and orators, and then later on, we meet this kind of odious character, Cleomedes, is that right? And he is way over the top. You mentioned Nietzsche comes in, the Superman.
Oh, yes, of course. Yes, Callicles and the Gorgias.
Callicles.
Yes, he's absolutely a Nietzschean character. Might is right. Yes.
And you use the word Superman. I think these days we probably use the word strongman. But take us from the battle of the speaking types of oratory. That the speaker who seeks only to excite and agitate his audience versus informing his audience, and then take us to the strongman ruler.
Wow, that's a mega question. My goodness me. Well, yes. So let's start by looking at this bunch of characters called sophists at the time. They were traveling professional teachers of philosophy and rhetoric, traveled the Greek world, who taught rich young men, or at least the sons of rich fathers, how to get ahead in public life, which at the time meant knowing how to win an argument, because the way to get ahead in public life depended on your speaking skills in the assembly, in the law courts. That was what you needed. And Plato's complaint about the sophists is that way too often they just teach you how to win the argument by any means, fair or foul. You can win it by bullying and threats and intimidation, or you can win it through verbal skullduggery and fallacious arguments and smokescreen. And he says, you know, some of these are thugs and bully boys, and others are snake oil merchants, as we might put it. And they're not teaching you how to look for the truth or the good life. Let me rephrase that. They're certainly not teaching you how to look for the truth. And they're not looking to teach you what Plato thinks is the good life, this inner psychic harmony aimed on the fulfillment of your faculties. Because Plato says they've misunderstood human nature. We've talked about the three faculties that Plato thinks are important, the reason, the spirited element, and the appetitive element. And he says these sophists, they miss out the reasoning element. They're not interested in it, really. They're not interested in truth and reality. They're interested in success, victory, power over others. That's a kind of perversion of the spirited element. And they're interested in material wealth, how you can get rich, how you can use your rhetorical skills to get rich. So he says they can't teach you how to live the good life because they've not understood what it is. They haven't understood what it is to be a human being. And because they haven't understood what humanity really is, they can't tell you how to live a good human life. And he absolutely, in the dialogue called the Gorgias, he takes on this very scary kind of proto-Nietzschean character called Callicles, who absolutely believes might is right and is totally against democracy, though ironically he's trying to get voted in as a democratic leader in democratic Athens, but he actually privately despises democracy, and he thinks that some men, and I do mean men, not women, he's very male orientated, are just born more, just stronger and more powerful and more courageous and more, quote, manly, his words, not mine, than others. And it's these natural strong men who should have more power, who should have more wealth. It's might is literally right. It is right that these naturally strong few should be given power or should take power and should have more material wealth than others. And it's a really strong thesis. And now he, in the Gorgias, Callicles links it to private hedonism and says that it's also right in your private life to be an unqualified hedonist and to just let all your desires hang out and satisfy any of them as they come along. Now, in the Gorgias, the character Socrates defeats the unqualified hedonism argument, and he convinces Callicles he's not actually an unqualified hedonist because he doesn't actually support the pleasures of the coward. He doesn't like cowards, but Socrates in the Gorgias never defeats the might is right argument, and we come back to it in the Republic with another sophist called Thrasymachus, and he says, and he takes over those arguments from Thucydides that we were looking at earlier, and saying really there's no such thing as international justice. It's just the strong do what they can and the weak accept what they must, and you know, if you go in and whoever's in power, they just make the laws in their own interest. And if you follow the laws, you're just giving the rulers what they want, and you're a mug and you're a fool and you've been taken in. And it's entirely cynical.
Sheeple.
Absolutely. So, and Plato then spends the next, so they're not quite the same. I mean, both Callicles and Thrasymachus, they both admire what they see as the strong man, that this person who is naturally strong and courageous and brutal and ruthless and so on. There are some differences between them, but basically they have a might is right philosophy. And Plato spends the next nine books of the Republic trying to tackle that by saying, no, they've misunderstood human nature. They've misunderstood human happiness. They're not offering you a good life. And he sets up his supposedly ideally just state run by these philosopher rulers who rule for the good of the state of the whole, not just for themselves. But, and this is, I think, what you're alluding to, at the end of Book 8 in the Republic, Plato says that even the ideal state, because it's invented by humans, it will decline. And because everything made by humans and inevitably degenerates, and it declines first to what he calls a timocracy, which is a state ruled by love of honour and victory, a very military state. He has Sparta in mind. And then it degenerates into oligarchy, where the rich just want to get money for themselves. And then the oligarchy descends into democracy. I'm afraid democracy comes forth in Plato's hierarchy. But remember, he's not talking about representational democracy. He's got no knowledge of that. He's talking about the direct democracy of his contemporary Athens, which was really extreme. You just voted the male citizen body, and it was only men voted on laws by just voted on the laws, and they could change their mind the next day. And the major positions in the state were elected by lot. I mean, I could wake up tomorrow and be Chancellor of the Exchequer. And I can tell you now that would be a disaster. I mean, it's not going so well with our current lot, but, you know, it would be worse. Anyway, and so Plato's not a great, he says, you know, democracy is very charming and it's fun and it's colourful and it's the most enjoyable state to live in. But he says, and this speaks to what you were asking about, he says, it does have flaws. It's chaotic. It's fickle. People don't pay attention. And crucially, all those, that inattentiveness makes it very vulnerable to attack, both from without, but particularly from within. And then you get, to my mind, what's one of the most brilliant passages in the Republic, when he absolutely incisively outlines how a democracy can be subverted to tyranny by a cynical and opportunistic demagogue. And it is extraordinary. And this is written in the 370s BCE. So he says, first of all, the demagogue gets himself elected in through democratic means. And he does this by making wild promises. And he particularly offers the people, the electorate, freedom. That's his banner, his watchword, freedom, liberty. He gets into power and he creates this cult around himself whereby his supporters think he can do no wrong. And he then starts subverting the legal and judicial systems and brings baseless charges against his opponents. Not unnaturally, that creates enemies, and occasionally the opponents are able to get rid of the demagogue, at least briefly. But then he often comes roaring back into town, and Plato says if he comes back, the second time is much worse. I promise you, this is written in the 370s BCE, because he comes back thirsting for revenge and absolutely unshackled.
Boy, that's terrifying.
He keeps creating laws. He keeps creating wars and trouble and disquiet and unrest because he wants to keep the people frightened, because then they will feel in need of a strong leader. So the demagogue wants the people to be scared, because then they will feel they need him. He also, and we often forget this, because it was the poor who voted him in, he wants to keep them poor. So he does not want them to get rich or educated or anything, because then they'll sort of start to see through him. So he keeps them poor. And if they start complaining and saying, well, this isn't why we voted you in, he turns on his initial supporters too, because by this time, he's built up his own private army. He doesn't trust the state army to look after him. He builds up a private bodyguard and then his own private army. And once he's got military force on his side, he no longer needs the support of the electors who initially voted him in. So if they start complaining and saying, we don't want this unrest, we don't want these wars, we don't want to be so poor, he just says, tough luck, because he doesn't need them anymore. He doesn't need democracy anymore. He's used democracy. He's destroyed democracy. He can now throw democracy away. And Plato says the full-blooded tyrant is born. And Plato does not mince his words. He says the man becomes a wolf. So it's utterly incisive. And Plato knew what he was talking about, because he'd travelled a lot. He'd visited the court of the tyrant Dionysius I in Syracuse in Sicily, only just got away with his life because he kept criticising tyranny to the tyrant's face. So Plato had seen tyranny in action, and he knew how it operated and how it gets in, all smiles, all promises, and then just start subverting all the legal, judicial, all the other institutions to amass power. And one of the things that Plato is, I think, just terrifyingly prescient about is he says that as the demagogue starts to become a tyrant, the demagogue says that he is the people. He equates himself with the people. And he says, anybody who opposes me and complains about what I'm doing is actually a hater of the people. We've seen this, haven't we, in tyrants throughout history, l'état c'est moi, you know, and we saw this in 1930s Germany. I mean, Hitler was saying the same thing. He was the state. So tyrants and would-be tyrants always start to say, I represent the people. I am the people. So anybody who criticizes me, you're criticizing the whole people. And I can therefore have you put to death or exiled or imprisoned or whatever as a result. So, yeah, I mean, we need to pay attention. And Plato is very clear that the rot sets in through the subversion of language, the misuse of terms like liberty, like freedom, like democracy, and particularly the misuse and subversion of moral terms. So a word like, license is liberty is called license, and shamelessness is called courage, and so on. And he says, when you start to get sloppy about language and misuse language, that's when the rot starts to set in and people become lazy and inattentive, and they don't see the damage being done to them until it's too late. So one of the things we can do to protect ourselves, the implication is to be really watch the language that is we hear, that we read, that we use ourselves, and call out misuses of language. When we see all around the world, don't we? Words literally being used to mean their opposite.
In an old episode of Doctor Who, which you mentioned, Doctor Who in this book, there's a evil bad guy who says, deep inside, Doctor, we all want the same thing, freedom from fear, freedom from pain. The Doctor finishes up with, freedom from freedom.
Yes, that's exactly that is so right. So Plato has given us the clearest possible warning in the 370s, and he is saying to us, pay attention. You need to call out what you're seeing, what you're reading. I mean, I often think, what would Plato think about social media and all the algorithms that are being used? I mean, the fake AI. I mean, we have to so check what we're seeing, what we're hearing, what we're reading. Check the source. Don't just share stuff without really checking out whether the source is genuine. Do you believe something because you just want to believe it? You know, we know the algorithm is feeding us stuff that it thinks we want to see and hear. And that is really dangerous, that we're being fed stuff that it thinks we will like, and that is going to divide us from other people in our society. So, I mean, I'm sure he would want social media to be publishing platform subject to editorial controls, but we're a long way from that. So he would say the only other way to do this is education. Education certainly of the young, but also of adults. We need to see through the lies and deceptions and fantasies that we're being fed.
And with the help of books like yours, we can. The new book by Angie Hobbs is Why Plato Matters Now. Read it now. Thank you for joining me, Angie.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.